Yes, and Is anybody there?
I'm here.
Oh, hi.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Please join me in saying the Ana Bekoach. Ana Bekoach, Gedulat Shemincha, Tatir Serura. Aleph Bet Gimel Yud Tav Tzadi. Kabel Rinat Amcha Sagvenu Tacharenu Nora Kufrei Shayan Sintet Nun. The letters of the month of Adar, the Kuf that created the constellation Pisces, Dagim, the fishes, and the Gimel that created the planet Jupiter, the planet Tzedek. The two letters are translated as monkey, which is the kuf, and camel, which is the gimel. What these two animals teach us is has the energy of the month of Pisces, the month of Adar. They both are joyful animals. The month of Adar is that of joy, as our sages have said. When Adar comes in, joy increases. Na gibor dor shei yehudcha kivavat shamrem. Nun gimel dalet yud kaf shin. The sequence Yud Kaf Shin is a healing sequence that allows us to take any part of our body that needs healing back to its stem cell state. And then, after it has been cleansed and healed and rejuvenated, return it to the body where it will again do its job as it was meant to do, as it was created to do, in a newly pristine state. Barchem tacharem, rachamei sitkatcha, tamin gamlem, betetresh tzaditav gimel. Chasin kadosh, berov tuvcha, na'el adatach. Het kufbet, tet nunayim. Yachid ge'e, lamcha p'nei, zokre kidushatach. Yud gimel lamed, pei zayin kuf. Shavatenu kabel, ushma tziakatenu, yodea talumot, shinkufav tzadiyudtah. And the four verses that connect to the energy of last year, where we don't want to fall back and lose the energy, lose what we have gained in the form of a peace treaty in the south, and we want to move that same energy forward and grow that peace treaty to be true for the north as well as the east, as well as the Mediterranean, as, of course. And the three verses that we will utilize this year to connect to the energy of this year that will allow us to see through the illusion and eliminate the angel of death. Usamti makom leami leIsrael untati v'shakam taktav v'lo yirgaz od v'lo yosifu v'nei avla anoto ka'asher barishona. That verse was Samuel Bet, chapter 7, verse 10. The three verses from the energy of this year. The first verse is from Job, chapter 7, verse 19. Kamalo tishemimeni lo tarpeni adbili ruki. And then a verse from 1 Samuel, chapter 23, verse 23. Uru udu mikol hamachavoyam asher yitchabe sham ushavtem elai el nachon v'halachti idchem v'chayayim yeshno v'aretz v'chipasti oto b'kol afe Yehuda. And the third verse is also from Job, chapter 20, verse 7. Kigelo lanetzach yovedo roav yom ruayo. Now we're going to read from the Zohar, from the Parasha of Terumah, section 1, Pasuk 4. And we start out with the L'shem Yehud phrase that aligns our consciousness with the unification of Zeranpin and Malchut, unifying male and female, unifying the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, and the Hey, bringing unity between our consciousness and the consciousness of all of creation. L'shem Yehud Kudsha Barichu Ishkinte Bidgilu Urchimu Udchilu Le'akta Shem Yudke Bevavke B'Yehuda Shalim B'Shem Kol Yisrael V'nad La'chela Me'alma Ila'a Al'yada Yaakov Shalema Techi Berlon Kachada Chi Berlon Kachada Le'ela le'vechiber lon kachada le'tata umitaman nafku tiresar shivatin kadishin kegavna bilela yako Dechawa shalim ail rechimu beitren almin kimadio kimna she'ar b'nei nasha diavdin kidein megalin eryan le'ela wetata Garim devavu bitrein almin Wegarim peruda ahidiktiv eisha elachota lotikach litzror teitavedu mare devavu Dalida. And Malchut receives strength, that is, Mochin, Hebrew word for brains, from the supernal world. Put Hebrew word Mochin in Kala means the upper three Sephirot. That is Mochin from the supernal world, which is Binah, by means of Jacob, the whole man, who united them together by elevating Mayim Nukvim, female waters. He has elevated Malchut into Bina, and they got connected one with the other. He connected them together above, so that Bina received the shape of Malchut, and is the secret of Leah. He also connected them together below, so that Malchut acquired the shape of Bina, and is the secret of Rachel. And the 12 holy tribes came out from there in the likeness of the above. In other words, as the 12 aspects that exist in the upper Malchut, Jacob, who was whole, brought love into the two worlds, as we have stated, that he wedded two sisters, Leah and Rachel, who are the secret of the two worlds of Bina and Malchut. Other men who do such a thing merely commit sexual misconduct, both above and below, and cause antagonism in both worlds and engender separation between Zeronpin and Leah and between Zeronpin and Rachel. Since he unites with Leah from the chest above and with Rachel from the chest below, it is written, neither shall you take a wife to her sister as her rival. A verse from chapter 18 of Vayikra, many of the sexual no-nos are listed in by that chapter of Vayikra. So that they become rivals and full of hatred toward each other. What is being explained here is how there are exceptions to every mitzvah. Every mitzvah that says, do this mitzvah, there are conditions when they are met, when we are not to do that mitzvah. And every mitzvah that says, do not do this mitzvah, there are conditions when they are met that we are supposed to do that mitzvah, that action. And the only way where you know what is the right thing to do is when you are connected on the level of your intuition that is above logic. Some people call it the unconscious, but it's even higher than your unconscious. Your intuition is the quantum consciousness of humanity, that once you have reached that level, your actions will always be righteous, always be right, always be correct. It's not an easy level to reach. But it can be reached. And that's what this verse is giving us the information for us to realize that. Are there any questions? Tonight's class is a question and answer series. I have a few questions that came in, I got by email, but I'd like to ask if there are anybody online listening to the call right now being recorded that would like to ask a question. One question that I was asked by email by a student. It's a simple question without a simple answer. The simple question is, why is this world an illusion? Understand that that statement, this world is an illusion, doesn't really explain why. This world is an illusion, and I could answer this question by saying that's the way it is. And that is the way one of my teachers answers. Because to go into the logic of why the world is illusionary, why did Hashem create it this way, asks us to think and become the mind of God. Something that as long as we're in a physical body, we're not able to do so. And the same kind of logic and answer applies to every mitzvah, whether it's a do mitzvah or a do not mitzvah. Why did God give us this mitzvah? Well, some people will say it can be understood. Some of them can be understood. But other people say, even if you think you understand why there is this mitzvah, you need to struggle and strive to perform and reach and do this mitzvah. And you really cannot understand this mitzvah because it's coming from the mind of God. And do it because He commands you to do it. And then along comes the Zohar and confuses us with the statement in the Parasha of Tzav that a command is idol worship. And we have explained this logically with the metaphor. If someone asks you to turn on the light in the room, and you get up and go turn on the light in the room, who turned on the light in the room? The person who got up and walked over to the light switch? Or the person who asked that person to do that action? And we answer it that both did. Both are co-creators of the revelation of that particular life in that particular room. So why is this world an illusion? On one level, it's an illusion because your senses are created so you do not see and know everything about you. Man can build instruments that have a broader range of ability to see light. So that we have instruments that can give us infrared and ultraviolet and levels and frequencies of light that we cannot see. And this applies to sound as well. The human ear has a limitation of what range of frequency of sound it can register, and it can understand, it can hear. And there's a sensitivity to cold, to touch, because if we put our finger in cold water, almost freezing water, and then put it into boiling water, we can't tell the difference in the temperatures through our touch. So all of our senses, I could go through taste as well, and smell, all of our senses were created with a limitation so that we will not see and know all aspects of the meanings or the essence of that sense. And that's why the world is an illusion, because the world was created with dimensions and frequencies of light and sound and touch that we have no ability to sense. And that's why it's an illusion. But of course, that doesn't answer the question, why did God create the world as an illusion? And so some people will take it to a deeper level and answer the question by saying, God created it as an illusion so that we would have the work of separating between good and evil. That the tree of knowledge, good and evil, is mixed, and it is man's job to separate those two energies. And the way to do that, because spiritually these two energies, good and evil, Tov and Ra, cannot exist together. Hot and cold, something is 100 degrees Celsius, which is the boiling point of water, or something is 0 degrees Celsius, which is the freezing point of water. You can't have ice and boiling water exist together, except in the physical world. So it must be an illusion that I can put a stick in a fire on one end and a refrigerator on the other end, and both hot and cold now exist within the framework I have called stick in that metaphor. And that's the meaning of the illusion. That is why Hashem created the illusion, so that we would have the ability to separate between hot and cold, good and evil, that we could cut the stick in half. And therefore, be able to separate between two different essences. But is that truly the reason why this world is an illusion? Why God created it as an illusion? When we truly begin to understand what is evil, we begin to understand that evil is good because it motivates the change within us. And so therefore, what we perceive as good and evil being an illusion isn't really true. What is the illusion is that they can appear in the same location, the same essence. Most people would say to you, love and hate are opposites on a circle. But as you learn more, you realize that love and hate are not opposites, they're right next to each other, because they're both emotions. But indifference, that's the opposite of love. Why? Why is this world an illusion? I've given you many different explanations, none of which go to the core of the question. Because as long as we're in a human body, this is something we are not able to delve into. We are not the mind of God, and we cannot understand the mind of God. Keter translates as crown, the highest sephirah. Malchut, the lowest sephirah, translates as kingdom. What does the crown have to do with the kingdom? Is it an illusion or is it essence? Is the manifestation of the kingdom in the Keter, in the crown? Remember, the Malchut, when it moves to the different frame of reference, becomes the Keter for the next generation. This world is illusion. And because it is an illusion, it causes us to question and grow, to grow spiritually, to grow physically, to become more than we would be if it wasn't an illusion. And for me, at this time, that is the deepest answer that I have come up with, that I realize that works for me. I hope it works for you. I hope it answers the question for you. But if not, it's a question you need to contemplate yourself as you grow. And the way you contemplate it today hopefully will be a different answer when you contemplate it a year from now, and 5 years from now. And just as the light of the Big Bang, the energy of the Big Bang, continues to expand and separate and create more space, so will we, as we struggle to understand the mind of God. Would anybody like to ask any questions about that answer? Or any other question? I received an email this week from the, the writing of a female rabbi who writes a commentary on, blog that's called Kol Isha. And there are many female rabbis who write commentaries on this blog, sometimes every day, sometimes once a week, sometimes not even once a week. But one of my students had sent me this blog, and I have seen this blog and understood it, and the student didn't ask me to comment on it, but thought it would be meaningful to me. So it's a title of the blog is Mishpatim, the Angry Ox and the Chapel Hill Shootings. For those of you who may not follow the news, the Chapel Hill shootings. There's a community outside of Washington, I believe, or in the Carolinas. I'm never really sure. Where a man who identifies himself as an atheist shot and killed three young, effective Muslim workers in the peace movement. And he said he did this in a dispute over a parking space. And the social media is attacking the statements and saying it must be a hate crime. And the federal government is in the process of investigating. And the outside world is pointing the fingers at the United States for being racist, etc. But let's read what she says. It's a Devar Torah that she gave for the Torah, for the Parasha of Mishpatim, which we read this past Shabbat. In this week's Torah portion, we receive a wealth of ethical commandments. I disagree with that statement, but most rabbis and most students of Torah will tell you that it is true that the mitzvot are ethical, that the Eser Dibrot, the ten utterances, are ethics and morals. As I have explained that, in my opinion, they're not, and the Kabbalah teaches that they're not, but we'll leave that alone. This is her opinion, and she's entitled to it, and we're entitled to understand what she is saying and see if it applies and that there's an element of truth to it. For instance, when an ox gores someone to death, kill the ox, but don't punish its owner, unless the ox has been in the habit of goring, and its owner knows that, but fails to guard it, and it gores someone to death. Then punish its owner, because the person who had responsibility failed to act. I've read this verse many times, the rabbi says, but this year I couldn't help reading it through the lens of the news story that I followed this week. A few days ago in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a man entered the apartment of two neighbors and shot the couple and the woman's younger sister in the head, execution style. He later turned himself in and claimed that he had killed them over a parking dispute. The three young people who were murdered were Dea Shadi Barakat, Yusar Mohammed, and Razan Mohammed. Abu Salha, age 23, 21, and 19. Dea and Yusar were newlyweds, married in December. They were dentistry students who donated their dental expertise to the local homeless community, taught kids about dental hygiene at the local library in their spare time, and raised money and dental supplies to take to Turkey so they could help Syrian refugees. Razan was a college kid, a student of architecture and environmental design. All three of them were pillars of their community. All three of them were practicing Muslim. This act would be atrocious no matter who the victims were, but it is extra heartbreaking to me, the rabbi, because they were so young and so idealistic and so full of life. The man who killed them was a known anti-theist, not merely an atheist, but someone who loathed religion. He had posted nasty anti-Muslim language on Facebook. He had harassed these victims before. The young married woman had told her father he hates us because of who we are. What he did was beastly. And when I read the verses about the ox who gores someone to death, I think of this man who killed three innocent souls for reasons I cannot begin to fathom. And then I wonder who is responsible for the behavior of this particular ox. In the Torah, the answer is clear. It's the owner. If that owner had any suspicion that the ox would behave in such a way. In Torah, it is also clear that we are to regard ourselves as our brother's keepers. We are responsible for each other. Torah calls us to guide each other in lives of righteousness and to rebuke each other when needed. Granted, Torah is speaking in terms of the us of the children of Israel, the Jewish community. The Torah presumes that Jews are obligated to take care of Jews. But today our world is more pluralistic. We're part not only of the Jewish community, but also the American community. And many of us have connections to other religious communities through marriage or friendship or affinity. In today's paradigm, Torah might teach that we all have a civic obligation to each other. American culture, media, and stereotypes devalue the lives of Muslims and the lives of people of color. This happens in a million tiny ways, and it is constant and omnipresent. I fear that this persistent devaluing of these lives teaches us subconsciously that these lives have lesser value. I don't know whether this massacre could have been prevented, but I believe that an American culture of fear and suspicion of Muslims contributed to this killer's willingness to shoot these three young Americans in the head in their own home. And I believe that if we don't act to change our nation's culture, there will be more killings like this one. And all of us who sat idly by will be the ox owner who could have stopped the ox. How can we change the culture of an entire nation? It's too big a task, but we can begin by teaching our children that we value diversity. We can teach them that the great thing about a world filled with people who look, dress, or worship differently than we do is that we can learn from and about each other. We don't need them to be afraid of each other. We can begin by educating ourselves about the experiences of other people and other communities in this country. We can begin by expanding the circle of people about whom we care. One of the reasons I care so much about this story is that people in my life care about it. On Wednesday morning, as the news was breaking, I was homesick with a virus and was in bed with my iPad. I watched on Twitter as my Muslim friends grieved these killings. I learned about the victims. I read Muslim responses to the awful news. My heart went out to my friends and by extension to their whole community. I came to care deeply about this story. Excuse me. Many of us in this room have that kind of relationship with Israel. We know people there, or we have family there, or we visited there, or we feel connected with our fellow Jews there. So we pay attention to the news from there. And when there is death there, we grieve. My husband Ethan has that relationship with Ghana. He's lived there. He has a deep network of community there. And because he cares deeply about West Africa, he's emotionally invested in what happens there. It's easier to care about something, a person, a place, a community, when you have a personal connection. How can we grow our personal connections with communities beyond our own so that when something like this happens to someone in another religious community, we feel it also? We can begin by striving to teach ourselves to respond to differences, not with fear or anxiety, but with kindness and compassion. The verse most often repeated in Torah is, "Love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." That verse is repeated 50 times in the Chumash. For me, the place where this work always begins, where it has to begin, is with love. That is the end of the Devar Torah, the end of the written Devar Torah. Rabbis do write their speeches out, and many times they publish them like this rabbi did. But what is being left out of this Devar Torah? There are beautiful concepts in this Devar Torah. Love the stranger. Feel the pain of other communities. There are many other powerful emotions that we are being asked to feel. And when we look at those emotions, we think to ourselves, we should feel those emotions. And that's true. There is an ox, and the code word in the Torah is ox. And the ox is an animal that is generally patient and does its work because it's yoked. But when it decides on its own to not accept that yoke any longer, it gores, sometimes to death, God forbid. But what does the Kabbalah teach us about death? It teaches us that no one dies without proper provocation. No one dies without a judgment by a spiritual higher court saying this person needs to die. These three people were shot in the head. What does that tell us about the area of their life that caused them to become to the attention of the angel of death, who went to the court and asked for the souls, asked for these three children, because they were young, they were children, these three children to be shot in the head? And the court said, yes, it's time that they left. Maybe it will motivate change in other people. Maybe they will have completed their tikkun, and because their soul root comes from Cain, who killed Abel, they have to die. And this is the way that it should happen. We learn in Kabbalah that there are reasons for all of this. And we need to feel the pain of people who lose children. And we need to teach our children to respect diversity. And we need to stop being fearful. Because The only time we die is because a court said we should die. Yes, I know the Zohar says, when the angel of death is given permission to be chaotic, to bring chaos to a town, to a community, to the world, that we need to hide ourselves and stay away from the marketplaces, stay away from being noticed. Because even if we're righteous, we can be taken down by the angel of death. But ultimately, no one dies without that upper court saying he has to die. So what is there to fear? The fact that we have not done teshuvah, that we have learned to view the world in an upside-down manner vis-a-vis the spiritual laws and the spiritual perceptions. I don't know what these three people did in their previous lifetimes that said they needed to leave this world. What I do know is that's truth. That doesn't give me the right to point to their parents and say you didn't teach your children properly. I have to love the stranger. I have to love the ger. Because God commands me to do? No. Because it's the right thing to do. We live in a country that has a model justice system, one of the seven mitzvot of Noah. And yet we all know that on a physical level, this justice system is perverted. We follow a murder of a sniper. We follow his murder. And the man says, I didn't know it was wrong at the moment I pulled the trigger, but then I understood it was wrong and I had to escape. I don't know what the result of that trial will be, but there are many times when it isn't merciful. And it's a lot of resources used for that. But of course, that person cannot be put to death unless the upper court says it's time for him to be put to death. There's no right or wrong here. There's the opportunity to look deeper into our own motivations, our own reactions, and recognize nothing happens in this world. Nothing happens in this world that without a connection to correction. And we need to look for Hashem in those experiences. We need to look past the illusion and see the correction. And someone will say, but how can you know what they did in their last lifetime? They don't even know. And my answer is, yes, there are tools to know. If it's important to you to know, there are tools to find out. God does not do any action. He does not authorize the court to authorize the death of a person unless He first tells the tzaddikim of our world. He first tells the people, you have time to do teshuvah, change your ways. It's not that their ways are wrong because they're Muslim. In what way are they wrong? I don't know. I have made that effort. It's not important to me to learn this. What is important to me is that my students realize to look for Hashem in these actions. Are there any questions? I wish all of you a beautiful week. I remind you that tomorrow at 7 p.m. is our Rosh Chodesh connection. It's time to be happy. It's time to be certain. It's time to look for Hashem in the illusion. That's the message of the Purim scroll. That's the message of the masks and the costumes that we wear. That's the message of getting drunk so that we cannot tell the difference between blessing Haman and cursing Mordechai. Tomorrow, meaning tomorrow night and Friday, is the first day of Adar. Next Thursday, next Wednesday night, is the 7th of Adar. We will have an all-night study, assuming I can stay up. We shall see. Please join us. Join us Saturday night at 7 o'clock for a Zohar class. Join us Sunday morning for our spring and summer holiday preparations. Purim, Pesach, the Omer, and Shavuot, and many others. Shalom to all of you. Have a beautiful Shabbat if we don't speak to you tomorrow. Have a beautiful month. Rosh Chodesh Tov. Shalom.
Shalom.
Thank you. Shalom. Bye.